Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hello, followers. Before we begin, this story is part of the On the Trail of the Vampire universe. More specifically, a direct continuation of On the Trail of the Vampire, Diary Entry Number 3. All past installments can be found in the description below. As always, thank you for listening. Now, let's delve into the dark together. Your discretion is advised. It was May of 1988, just before 8 p.m. on a cool and breezy evening. My old truck rocked back and forth as I drove over the scattered minefield of potholes that led into the parking lot of Captain Jack's, my neighborhood's shithole bar. The damn holes just kept expanding year after year, but I knew that in a dying town like mine, there was little money, no incentive to get them fixed. Captain Jack's. I always thought the name was a fucking joke, since there wasn't a body of water within 100 miles of the place. As I drove through the lot, a quick scan of the cars told me which of the town regulars were already inside. One of the perks of living in a small Appalachian coal mining town. As I turned off the engine to my 1980 Toyota pickup, the engine proceeded to knock and wheeze for an embarrassing eternity before finally sputtering and giving up the ghost. Up until my fortunes had changed in the past month, I barely had 2 pennies to rub together, let alone enough money to take the truck, with its worn-out seats and rusted bed, to my local grease monkey for a long overdue service. I made a mental note to finally get that done. I got out of the truck and stretched. The night sky was dark and cloudy, and the smell of ozone told me a thunderstorm was rolling in. I looked up at the dilapidated sign overlooking the bar. The old neon lights had long ago stopped working, and I could barely read the fading letters that were illuminated only by the dim moonlight. The captain, as we locals affectionately called the place, was a dump when I got my first legal drink there on my 19th birthday, and now, 2 years later, it was still a dump. Nothing much had changed about the place, except the state of West Virginia had raised the drinking age from 19 to 21 in 1986. Not that the law really mattered. Down in the hollows of Appalachia, we had a long history of moonshining, or in legal terms, illicit distilling. My great-grandpappy was well known in these parts for his moonshine stills that worked at full capacity during the Prohibition of the 1920s. As a kid, I was fascinated with his stories of run-ins with the federal revenue enforcers, called revenueers, by the locals, who targeted Appalachia as a hotbed of bootlegging and moonshining. Yeah, I have to make it clear. My great-grandpappy hated being called a bootlegger. The term bootlegger is said to have originated with the mandate against the sale of alcohol to Indians, when traders often concealed flasks of liquor in their boots to avoid detection. By the early 20th century, a bootlegger was technically the seller of illegal alcohol. The moonshiner was the producer, and those who transported the products were called runners or blockaders. My great-grandpappy and a few of my other relatives continued producing illicit whiskey after the repeal of Prohibition in 1933 and the establishment of the alcohol tax up until as late as the 1950s. These days, old Mr. Jackson out on Tapper Road was about the only moonshiner left, keeping his still disguised as a chicken barn out in the woods behind his place. His homemade, unaged whiskey was distinguished by its clear color, corn base, and high alcohol content, which in a good batch would reach as high as 190 proof. Packaged in mason jars, his hooch was known to surreptitiously pop up in many a town shindig, definitely livening up any wedding, wake, or graduation party. Over the time, though, as our little community continued to dwindle down, the captain became the only legal public watering hole in the local area. The town's losers, like me, pretty much call it home. As I pushed open the front door, the rusted and neglected hinges squeaked like a startled mouse. Once inside, I stood for a moment to let my eyes adjust to the interior gloom. Loretta Lynn's melodious voice filled the room, playing from the old vintage 45 RPM jukebox in the far corner. Not surprisingly, the song was her 1970 hit, Coal Miner's Daughter. Almost 20 years later, the locals here still loved the lyrics that hit so close to home. We were poor, but we had love. That's the one thing Daddy made sure of. He shoveled coal to make a poor man's dollar. And after all, Loretta was nearly one of our hometown girls, having been born just across the state line in Butcher Hollow, Kentucky. I sauntered over to the bar and pulled out my usual stool near the end where I could turn and lean back against the wall. As I sat, the old stool wobbled dangerously, and I knew it was only a matter of time until it gave way and I fell flat on my ass. The place was pretty quiet for a Tuesday night, but I saw some of the captain's usual clientele scattered around the room. Billy Sue Song and his brother Jesse were at a table in the back, and they gave me a friendly wave when I looked on over. They were both off shift from the K&J mines and shared a well-deserved schooner of beer. I knew they'd most likely close the place. Just another boys' night out while their wives were left alone at home tending to their growing brood of bored and disagreeable kids. At another table, I saw Daryl Spengler, maybe one of the oldest mine workers in town. His wife died just last year, and his two children recently left town for greener pastures. Now he has nothing but time on his hands. He just sat there and stared into his beer, no doubt thinking of happier times. Off in the adjoining pool room, I could see the twin Haywood boys, Cecil and Jimmy Lee, racking up another set. They had lived just down the road from my own family, and growing up, we were all pretty tight. Cecil's pappy gave him permission at 17 to join the army, and at the time I figured he'd made good by getting the hell out of this town. But 2 years later, he was back home, with a dishonorable discharge in his hands. Something about smashing the nose of a senior officer and putting two MPs in the hospital. Now he was down in the mines together with Jimmy Lee. I turned my head back around as Pete, the evening bartender, walked on over. Pete and I had been friends since the first grade. In a small, dead-end town like ours, you could count the number of students per grade on both your hands. And most of those were probably related to each other. In short, everyone knew everyone in our little township of Brewersville, West Virginia. One could compare it to that 1960s television series, Peyton Place, but a small town where everyone knows everyone and their most personal, scandalous secrets. The only difference was that we were not in the Northeast, and I don't think we had any scandalous secrets, unless maybe you count the time Pastor Tim found Miss Jesper, the town librarian, pocketing some of the tithing envelopes from the church's Sunday collection. "Hey, Kenny," Pete greeted. "I was worried." I gave a small chuckle. That was a question that still sounded surreal to me. I hadn't worked much in the past 2 years on account of the economy, and I sure as shit didn't want to work down in the mines like my pappy and grandpappy did, as well as all my uncles and most of my cousins. No, sir. The number 9 explosion in Farmington in November 1968 took my Uncle Jake, and he remains down in the darkness, along with 19 other miners still unrecovered 20 years later. And just 2 years ago, in November 1986, I lost my cousin Jeremy at the Love Ridge number 22 in Fairview. In that case, it wasn't due to a mining explosion. Instead, it was a nightmarish case of a raw coal pile he was stepping on suddenly collapsing, swallowing him in a hole and suffocating him. About the same as when old man Livingston's 10-year-old son fell into the grain silo, the boy got sucked in just like quicksand and went right down under. Drowning in grain or drowning in coal is equally terrifying, but the image of cousin Jeremy being sucked down into a black maw of coal was enough to give me nightmares, and I swore right then and there I'd never set foot in a mine. I had a rough go of it for a while, taking some menial maintenance jobs the mining company offered me above ground, and for a time I worked as a stock boy down at the Ben Franklin Five and Dime. And I admit there was a few patches when I swallowed my pride, taking the government unemployment benefits or sponging off my pappy. The latter particularly made me disappointed and ashamed of myself. Pappy was still in the mines himself, barely getting by, and I could tell from his wheezing cough that he caught the black lung. But he was all I really had, after Mama had had enough of the mines and left us 8 years ago for a better life in Charleston. So it was a big surprise to me and about everyone else in town when 2 months ago I landed a job that had nothing to do with the mining business, involved far less work, and entailed no risk or danger. Well, unless I tripped over my feet and fell down a flight of stairs, I guess. But more importantly, a job that paid nearly as well as the package of incentives I'd get from the mining company. It was a job that actually garnered some look of jealousy from many other men folk in the area. I couldn't blame them, really. I didn't get the job based on my qualifications or merit. I was simply one lucky son of a bitch. I was just the first one to notice a help-wanted advertisement in the Coal Valley Sentinel, and Brewersville's one and only newspaper. It caught my eye immediately. It read, "Looking for a caretaker to manage a large estate outside of Brewersville. Duties will consist of maintenance of the main home and outlying buildings, and general groundskeeping of the property. Generous pay and benefits. Call after 8 p.m. Hell, I thought. The ad must be for the old Barker place out on County Road 39. It's the only thing around that could be considered a large estate. It was the only familial home for the Barker clan, one of the largest families in the area that have made their fortunes from the mining business. The 300-acre property consisted of a large home, several detached guest houses, a large swimming pool, a tennis court, and an outdoor shooting range. The original part of the main home was built back in the 1930s as this area began booming from the mines, and additional extensions were built throughout the 1940s and the 1950s. Eventually resulted in a decent-sized mansion with around 20 bedrooms. The house contained several spacious dining rooms and even a ballroom. As a young boy, I remember going to several garden parties on the property, events that the Barkers hosted for many minor families that made up Brewersville. They also hosted a tremendous 4th of July party every year, opening their grounds to guests to enjoy a fabulous picnic and fireworks show. Even though the Barkers made their fortune on the backs of the miners, they poured a lot of their wealth back into the community through charities and economic investment. In turn, the local families loved them and held them in high esteem. Back then, the Brewersville was a model company town. I guess you could say the town's heyday, as well as that of the Barker estate itself, was in the 1960s. Then, at the end of the Vietnam War, in the mid-70s, the family was hit by a series of misfortunes. The first was the death of old man Barker, the patriarch of the family, in 1975. His only son, Matthew, took over the family business, but just 4 years later, in 1979, he and his wife were killed in a tragic car accident outside of Charleston, where he was attending an economic conference. The Barker family had already been dwindling with the younger generations moving away from coal country, so after Matthew's death, there was a void in company leadership till Nancy Barker, one of old man Barker's daughters, recently stepped up to the plate. By then, though, in the early 80s, coal production from the local mines had fallen to a new low, and profits were being outstripped by the company's debt. After a year at the helm, Nancy saw the writing on the wall and sold the mining rights to another company, K&J Coal. In the summer of 85, she packed her bags, shuttered the old house and property, and moved to greener pastures somewhere in Florida, thus ending her family's dynasty here in Brewersville. The town's fortunes withered along with it, unfortunately. The home stood vacant for several years, and then sometime last year the rumor was that the property had been bought by some out-of-towner with plans for some kind of development. So, after months of dead-end jobs and no prospects for anything with decent pay in the near future, I didn't hesitate calling the number from the ad. I didn't have any illusions that I might be too late in calling, or maybe wouldn't have the handyman skills necessary for the job, but I was desperate. And the thing is, desperation seldom leads to good results. Desperation usually results in bad decisions. And in my case, it was a real bad fucking decision to have dialed that number. I still remember the phone conversation like it was yesterday.
Hello?
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Came a deep, gravelly voice, inflected with some kind of foreign accent. Hello, sir. I began. My name's Kenny Grimes. I live in Brewersville, and I'm interested in applying for the caretaker position you advertised.
I see,
the man replied.
Thank you for your prompt response. Tomorrow morning at dawn, please go up to the main house of the old Barker estate, and in the foyer by the main door, you will find a set of instructions and a ring of keys to the property. Please follow all instructions to the letter. At the same location, once a week, you will find an envelope with your pay.
Sure, I replied, caught a bit off guard. But don't you want to hear my qualifications or do a job interview?
That won't be necessary,
replied the man, in an accent that I was now sure was Slavic, maybe Russian.
I'm sure you will meet the requirements for the job. But remember, Mr. Grimes, follow all instructions to the letter.
Yeah, sure, but before I could finish, I heard a click as the line went dead. I was left standing there, receiver in hand, and mouth hanging open in mid-sentence. What the heck? I thought. That was one strange conversation. But I chalked it up to the guy being some kind of eccentric. Weren't all those aristocratic Europeans a bit weird anyway? And not that I ever met a European before. At any rate, I wasn't about to kick a gift horse in the mouth. The next morning, I got up at O'Dark 30 and left my apartment. A one-room flea bag that I managed to rent above the town's failing Woolworths. The only perk of living there was being able to catch a good meal from time to time at the store's lunch counter. Well, when I had enough money, that was. As I headed out of town, I passed the main entrance to the K&J mine. The parking lot was full of cars, with most of the town's men reporting for the early shift down in the tunnels. Just another day having to leave their worried wives and families behind, not knowing if they would ever see each other again. Truth was, every day down in the mines was a crapshoot. As I drove past, I gave a silent prayer that all those brave men will be safely joining their families at the evening dinner table. Per my instructions, I arrived at the Barker estate just as the sun was rising. The first thing I noticed was that the gate to the property that led off the main road, locked for the past few years, was unchained and left hanging open. I drove the winding road through the woods until I reached the main house. There was a wide circular driveway in front of the home with a large, ornate water fountain in the center. It reminded me of something I'd seen on that current hit TV show, Dallas. You know, the ones about the rich old families in Texas. I parked and got out. The estate was quiet, except for the cawing of a large flock of black crows that had roosted in nearby trees. I recall a childhood memory of my grandma, herself as old as the Appalachian Hills, telling us children the cawing of crows was a warning of impending danger, and also symbolized an impending death, misery, or bad fortune coming one's way. That recollection unsettled me a bit, but I shook it off as I walked up to the house. It was even grander looking than I had remembered it, with its long wraparound country porch, huge bay windows, multiple gables, and round observation tower with its gold ornate wind vane on top. It truly was a magnificent home. I walked up to the front door and found it unlocked. As I was told, I found a folder of instructions and several rings of keys on a table in the front foyer. First thing to catch my eye was an envelope full of cash. I could barely believe my eyes as I pulled out all $100 bills. I quickly counted them and realized it was $2,000. I'm not ashamed to say I'd never held that much cash in my hand before. Hell, I never even had that amount in my checking account. My head was spinning as I read the attached note.
Mr. Grimes, please accept this amount as your retainer. Future pay will be every Friday in the same amount.
I was stunned. That kind of pay was equal to the hazard pay of the mines, multiple times more than I expected to be paid as a groundskeeper. In a state of disbelief, but nevertheless with a wide smile plastered across my face, I opened the folder and took out the letter that laid out my duties. My main responsibilities were as to be expected. Keeping the lawns, bushes, and trees around the main and guest homes neatly cut, trimmed, and pruned. The gardener's shed had a riding mower and all the yard tools required. I was to keep the main home and guest buildings in a good state of maintenance. There was a detailed list of what I had to keep clean and maintained within the home, with a rotating schedule of when each activity needed to be done by month and season. All the responsibilities were cut and dry, but as I read down further, I reached an unusual instruction that had me raising an eyebrow. It stated that my duties were to begin at sunrise and end at sunset, and not begin at, say, 9 and finish at 5, or work an 8-hour day. It specifically read,
"You may begin your duties any time after dawn, but under all circumstances you must be off the property at sunset. No exceptions."
That was certainly odd, and initially I couldn't figure out why the owner was so adamant I had to be gone at sunset, but I finally decided it must have something to do with personal liability, such as a concern I could have a mishap in the dark. That was perfectly fine with me. Obviously, in the winter months, following that rule would make for a very short workday. Then I came to the next rule.
"You have total access to the home, the guest houses, and the grounds, but under no circumstances are you to enter the basement of the main home at any time."
Okay, I figured. Probably the owner had stored some valuables down there. Not unusual for an owner to have an off-limits area, but the next instruction indicated there was more to it than that.
"In the event you hear sounds of movement or voices coming from the basement, you are to ignore them."
What the hell? I thought. Now, that's fucking really weird. The house was empty, wasn't it? Then I got to the very last bullet. It was the most unsettling of all. It read,
"As my employee, I expect your complete loyalty and discretion in all matters relating to what you do or see during your employment at this estate. Violations will be handled swiftly and appropriately."
I don't like the sound of that. It sounded quite ominous, I thought, even a bit threatening. It was a red flag that I should have heeded. I had second thoughts about taking the job, but the lure of that much money was enough for me to overlook the weirdness. I'd just make sure to follow the rules, and I'll have no problems, I thought. The letter of instructions was simply signed. Wojciech. Definitely Russian, I thought. Or Polish. No phone numbers if I had to get in contact with him. All adding to the mystery, I thought. I shoved any concerns aside and walked into the house. And thus began my first day on the job. Over the course of the next month, everything went smoothly. Any personal consternation I had after initially reading Wojciech's letter had long vanished. I showed up for work not long after sunrise each day, and I always made sure to leave just before sunset. None of the yard work was overly strenuous, and neither were the various maintenance tasks in the home. Sometimes it got a bit too quiet, working all alone in the middle of nowhere. I ended up buying a Sony Walkman cassette player so I could listen to music as I worked around the property. Often I finished the chores early, and on those days I'd do some reading while relaxing under the shade of the home's country porch. On a couple of the warmer days, I'd take a swim in the large pool, which I had also been instructed to keep clean and maintained. One afternoon, I even took advantage of the estate's outdoor gun range, sighting in a new scope on one of my hunting rifles. And every Friday, I found an envelope with my pay left on the table in the foyer. Only once did I find another note left by Wojciech with some other tasks he wanted to have done. Overall, the job was a breeze. I had plenty of free time, and I really enjoyed the fresh air while working outdoors. It was truly a dream job. A job sent from heaven. At least I told myself that. But every time I worked in the main house and passed by the door leading down to the basement, I always caught a vibe that I couldn't explain. Just passing by the door made me feel uneasy. Yes, I did check it on the very first day and found that it was indeed locked. After that, I never touched it again. I noticed the key ring had a key marked basement door, but there was no way I was ever going to use it. Wojciech's warning was still fresh in my mind. Fortunately, as the days passed, I never heard any sounds coming from the basement. I don't know what I would have done if I had. Now, having finished my first 2 months working out of the property, Pete was standing in front of me, having asked me his question.
Yeah, job's great, Pete,
I replied.
The owner seems to be satisfied with my work, so I guess I'm doing okay.
Pete smiled broadly.
That's super, Kenny. You're definitely getting a nice tan from all the outdoor work. I envy you, me having to work inside this pit. The doc says I need to take extra vitamin D, just like the miners. Hey, you ever met the owner yet?
He asked. I told him that I hadn't. Pete handed me a cold can of Falstaff. I pulled the ring tab and took a long pull. I sat there for a few minutes, mulling over the idea of ditching my broken-down Toyota and buying a brand-new Ford F-150 with my newfound wealth, when I heard the not-so-subtle squeak of the captain's front door opening. I turned my head to see who was walking in. There were two people, a young man and woman. They were obviously out-of-towners, as I'd never seen them before, but we didn't have many strangers come in here. Roseville was not a place likely to be mentioned in your Michelin guide as a town to sightsee around, let alone even to visit. So, I was immediately intrigued and continued to watch them as they took a seat at a table. At any rate, it would have been hard to take my eyes off the woman. I could see Jesse and Billy had also noticed her. Maybe around 30, she was knocked down, dropped dead, gorgeous. She had a classic 36-24-36 figure. Although she tried to hide it with a pair of manly cargo pants and a tweed sports coat that looked a size too large worn over her blouse. She was way taller than me, I guessed around 6'1" or 2". She had the most exquisite blonde hair which she wore laid and feathered, down past her shoulders. I couldn't help but be reminded of Farrah Fawcett, the beautiful actress from the hit TV show Charlie's Angels. And yeah, I'll admit it. Just with the millions of other red-blooded American teenage boys, Farrah's 1976 iconic red swimsuit poster had been prominently taped on my bedroom wall, where I could lay in bed and stare at her beautiful feathered mane of golden hair that cascaded and tumbled to her shoulders like a waterfall straight out of Bambi. Well, those perky nipples that jutted through her swimsuit so damn provocatively didn't go unnoticed either. It's no surprise it's considered to be the best-selling poster of all time, with over 12 million copies sold. And just as with Farrah, I could see that the stranger looked to be sporting a great-looking tan, serving to further accentuate her stunning body. As I mentally visualized her hidden tan lines, I came to the conclusion she either spent a lot of time at the beach, or she worked out a lot outdoors. I was guessing the latter, since she looked to be extremely well-toned and athletic. As I studied her, she suddenly turned her head and looked directly at me,
with the most piercing bright blue eyes. Just a fleeting glance before turning away. But in those few seconds, I had the distinct feeling she had been sizing me up as much as I was her. Appraising her surroundings, those cold, dispassionate eyes told me there was a lot more to her than just superficial good looks. I could sense that she was not a woman to fuck with. No, sir. I took a look at a friend. He was a tall one, too, although slightly shorter than her, maybe around 6 feet. Younger, too, but still older than me, and maybe in his mid-20s. Ruggedly handsome, with dark brown hair, cut short, military style. He had on a pair of straight-legged blue jeans and what looked to be just a simple white t-shirt, of which he wore a dark blue members-only jacket. Just like with the woman, he looked in great shape, athletic and fit, and the way they carried themselves, even of a certain vibe. Cops, I wondered. Maybe feds. Were they here looking for old man Jackson's illegal still? That wouldn't make any sense. Probably more likely about Jimmy Peterson.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Jimmy's wife, Pamela, disappeared a month back after I started working at the Barker place. There were a lot of outsiders in town then, investigating things. As far as I know, she never turned up. Jimmy was still working the mines, though. I heard the authorities came to the conclusion Pamela ran off. That news had really knocked me for a loop. Pam and I had dated our first 2 years of high school, and for a while, things were pretty hard and heavy between us. She was a sweet, kind, and generous girl, and I was really crazy about her. It was all my fault that we broke up. After my mother ran off, I went into a slump, and Pam became collateral damage. She and Jimmy then became a thing in our senior year and got married right after graduation. I was happy for her. They'd been married about 3 years now and had a son, Matthew. Every time I saw Pam and Jimmy together, they looked very much in love. That's why it was still hard for me to accept that she would have just run off, especially leaving a young son behind. I continued to watch the couple out of the corner of my eye as they ordered a round of drinks. The man's lean, clean-shaven face was accented by his boyish grin, and I couldn't help but notice how his hazel eyes never seemed to stray far from the woman's. Not just cops, I thought. Lovers, I deduced. There was no mistaking the chemistry between the two, and the mutual looks of affection. I watched as Pete brought them their order of drinks. The guy had a beer with a shot on the side. The woman was given a glass of whiskey, maybe 2 fingers worth. I wasn't surprised, I thought. She looked like she could drink with the best of them and kick their asses at the same time. When Pete came back around behind the bar, he walked on over.
"Hey, Kenny, do you hear the latest news about Kyle Peterson's girl?" he asked. Kyle Peterson was one of the foremen in the mines. He had worked for K&J Coal in another town before moving to Roersville 3 years ago when the company bought the mining rights. "What do you mean?" I asked. Pete pulled out the day's issue with the Coal Valley Sentinel. The newspaper's front page had a large article with the headline, "Local Miner's Daughter Missing," followed by, "Girl, 17, last seen leaving friend's home while walking down Boone Street." Pete tapped the page. "The article says Gail Peterson left the Murphy home around 8 p.m. last night. She was visiting Connie Murphy. They're classmates. She only lived 5 minutes down Moon, but she never made it. Article says they didn't find any trace of Gail at all. Rumor going around that even the dogs couldn't get a scent. This is weird shit, Kenny. No one's ever gone missing in this small town. Kyle and Claudia Peterson are a real mess. I heard Claudia had to be sedated. What a damn shame." I agreed with Pete. This town never had that kind of thing happen. Oh, sure, we had our share of domestic disputes, but we are a tight-knit community. Everyone looked out for each other. But to disappear, to be abducted, Shit. The chances were high for her to have been the victim of a wild animal attack. After all, the forest covered more than 75% of West Virginia. The black bear population had been growing steadily, nearly going extinct in the early 70s. However, unlike grizzly bears, black bears are typically avoiding the humans and are not normally aggressive. In fact, no fatal attack by a black bear had ever been confirmed in West Virginia. Coyotes are common in the state, with populations growing since some of their predators, like cougars and wolves, no longer live here. But they too rarely attack humans, with most of the incidents involving livestock or small pets. By far, the most dangerous animals in this area are our poisonous reptiles, the northern copperhead and the timber rattlesnake. Over the years on several hunt trips, I had more close calls with them than I would like to remember. The copperhead is more common throughout West Virginia, but is less venomous than the timber rattlesnake, which can grow as long as 6 feet. And the thing is, none of these animals, bears, coyotes, or snakes, could take out Gail Peterson without leaving a trace. I took another look at the young couple at the table. Could they be here because of Gail Peterson? I wondered. Well, I couldn't dwell on it any longer. It had been a long day, and I needed to be back out to the Barker estate at dawn. I paid for the beer and gave Pete a wave. As I got off the creaking stool, which threatened once again to collapse, I stole another sideways glance towards the strangers. This time I could see that they were both studying me. Yeah, cops, I again wagered. I deliberately walked past their table, returning their glance, and giving them a nod as I made my way out. The next morning at the Barker place, I could hear a rooster crowing from a nearby farm as I unlocked the gate at the crack of dawn. The weather was going to be clear and nice, so I figured I'd do the weekly mowing. I went into the main house and in the kitchen brewed a fresh pot of coffee. I was allowed to keep food in the fridge and utilize the kitchen as I saw fit, so I took out a carton of eggs to make myself breakfast. Half hour later, I had eaten and washed up my dishes. I had just grabbed the ring of keys from the landscaping shed and was beginning to leave when I heard something. Something I hadn't heard in the house before. It was indistinct, and I couldn't ascertain what direction it had come from, whether from inside or outside the house. I cocked my head and strained to listen. Nearly a minute went by. And just when I was ready to shrug it off, the sound came again. A voice, a cry, or a moan, I wasn't sure, from inside the house. Specifically, from behind the basement door. I froze. It couldn't be. I thought. I needed to hear it again, to confirm what I thought I heard. My legs felt like lead as I slowly made it over to the door. I put my ear against it and listened. A minute later, it came again. This time, there was no mistaking it. A high-pitched moan. Definitely a female's. Christ, I thought. How could anyone have gotten down there? There were no windows. The door is always locked. It's been locked for at least the 2 months I'd worked at the estate. At least that I knew of. Shit, I thought. What do I do now? My employer's instructions were specific. I was never to open that door. If I do it, I'd probably get fired. And I didn't want to lose the job. No way. Not over just because I thought I heard a girl's voice. There could be a natural cause, I rationalized. Maybe it's just something loose. Maybe a fan or something in the basement causing a squeaking sound. With the door in the way, it might be distorted somehow. Was I going to risk my job for something so ambiguous? Then, I suddenly thought about Gail Peterson. Missing over 24 hours now. It couldn't be, could it? I stood there, for I don't know how long, vacillating on whether to open the door. Finally, I heard yet another moan. That was enough for me. If there was a girl down there, I couldn't just leave her. I ran over to the table and swapped out the ring of keys. I grabbed the ring with the keys for the main home and ran back to the door. My hand shook as I found a key and inserted it into the lock. I tried to turn it, but it didn't work. Damn, I thought, it's the wrong one. I fumbled with the ring again and finally found a key marked basement. I had just pushed it into the lock when I heard steps coming up from behind me.
I wouldn't do that.
Came a female voice. I whirled around, my heart slamming in my chest. My eyes widened as I realized it was the man and woman from the bar the night before. Who the fuck are you? I demanded. You're not cops. I came to that keen deduction because they weren't wearing police badges around their neck. Instead, they were wearing crucifixes like a pair of fucking Opus Dei acolytes on sabbatical from the Vatican. The woman smiled.
You hear that, Jack? The country blumpkin thought we were cops.
The guy, obviously named Jack, smiled back and replied,
Well, Rox, you do come across as a little authoritarian. I keep telling you need to show your softer side more often.
Look, I told him, I don't know what your game is, but you're trespassing. This is private property. You need to leave, now, or I'm calling the real cops. The woman's smile disappeared. In a blink of an eye, she pulled out a pistol from under her sports coat. She jammed the muzzle right into my forehead. I dropped the ring of keys and put my hands up. I knew my guns. It was a Bren 10mm semi-automatic. The hammer was already cocked, and I knew it would make a grapefruit-sized exit wound in the back of my head if she gave the trigger just 4 pounds of pressure.
Listen, Kenny,
she started.
We're here on some serious shit. We don't have time to explain it, and even if we did, you wouldn't believe us. Jack and I are going down into the basement. You are going to stay right up here. Don't even think of calling the cops or running off. We'll explain everything in due course. Do you understand?
I nodded, but then I had to ask, Who are you? I blurted. How do you know my name? This time, it was Jack that spoke.
We've been watching you for some time, Kenny. Watching this place. We've been in town for a week, trying to make sure we were right. But after the Peterson girl was snatched, we knew we were, and that we couldn't wait any longer. And it's a good thing we walked in when we did, or you would have gone down in that basement. You'd probably be dead by now. Or worse.
I had no idea what he meant by that. But I come to the conclusion that they were serious people who meant business, even if they were total loons. I decided to play along. Okay, I replied, as I stepped away from the door. I got no dog in this fight. I just work here. If you want to go in the basement, then be my guest.
All right,
said Roxy, putting a pistol back into what I could see was a shoulder holster under her sports coat. Jack unslung a black bag he had been carrying over his shoulder and took out what looked like water pistols. He gave one to Roxy, as well as a large crucifix. He, in turn, took out another water pistol for himself and a weathered Bible that looked to be 100 years old. You're shitting me, I remarked incredulously. You're going down there with, what, fucking squirt guns? Crucifixes? Jesus, the next thing you'll tell me is that they're filled with holy water and you're going after a vampire. I laughed nervously, but the two of them just fixed me with deadpan expressions. Yeah, okay, I stammered. Sure, I get it. Roxy narrowed her eyes and looked at me coolly. For a second, I was afraid she was going to pull out the Bren 10 again and shoot me with it. Then, she said,
I don't think Kenny here believes in vampires, Jack. He thinks they're fiction, the stuff of movies. His idea of a vampire is probably a Bela Lugosi stereotype. And he's sure we're a pair of religious fanatics, or a bunch of Looney Tunes. Well, Kenny, let me show you what one of your movie vampires did to me 3 years ago.
She pushed back her blonde mane and turned her head to show me the right side of her neck. There, I could see an ugly scar, an actual depression in her neck, where it looked like a chunk of her flesh had been torn away. It was a terrible-looking wound, marring the features of such a beautiful woman. No wonder she wore her hair down around her shoulders.
And that was just a petite 17-year-old girl,
Roxy explained.
And yes, a vampire. Tanya is her name, and the bitch jumped me good. I damn near died.
She looked over at Jack, and I could see the pain of the memory on his face. He'd been there when it happened, I knew.
She's still out there,
Roxy continued.
She's killed countless people out on the West Coast, and tried to kill Jack's mother and sister. I still have to find her, so there's no fucking joke, Kenny. Not to me, not to Jack. Vampires are real, and I hate to break it to you, Kenny, but you've probably been working for one. Your employer, Wojciech. It's probably a miracle he hasn't turned you into a familiar yet, but it would have happened soon, I'm sure. We've been tracking him across the country. When he bought this estate, we knew he would be using it as his sanctuary in the south. And as such, Brewersville has become his new hunting grounds. We're pretty sure he abducted Pamela Peterson a month ago, and Gail Peterson 2 days ago. It's probably too late for Pamela, but with Gail, we don't know. That's why we need to get into the basement while it's still daylight, while the vampire is at rest. But every minute we're still talking to you is costing us precious time, when that young girl may be down there needing our help.
I don't know why, whether it was Roxy's intimate account of her attack, or her plea about needing to help Gail, but there was something in her voice that made me believe her. Maybe not in vampires, but that she and Jack were here for a good cause. Okay, that's it.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Looking her in the eyes, nodding. You guys go. The key's on the ring. I'll wait here, just as he asked. If you're right, I hope to God you find Gail. And that she's all right. I watched as Jack picked up the ring of keys. He found the right key and put it in the lock. He looked at Roxy, and she nodded. Jack turned the key, and I heard the deadbolt slide back. I watched as they both pointed their water pistols forward and held their crucifixes. Jack opened the door. All I could see was blackness. Jack reached out and searched for a light switch. He found it and flipped it. Nothing. A few more times. Nothing.
Flashlights.
He told Roxy. They pulled out lights and switched them on. Over Jack's shoulder, I could see the stairs leading down into the gloom.
I'll go.
I heard Roxy say. Jack turned around. No, I'll go first. He said.
I should go, Jack.
Roxy replied.
You know, to handle things.
Jack retorted.
Rox, I'll be fine. You have my back. Well, okay.
Jack, we asked.
But I'll be right behind you.
I rolled my eyes. Jeez, I thought. I wonder if these two were married. They sure as hell sounded like it. I watched them descend the stairs, their lights casting fleeting shadows along the wall. All I could see from the top was the landing at the bottom of the steps, but nothing more. Eventually, Jack and Roxy reached the bottom, and I saw them turn right and disappear out of view. After a few moments, I heard something crash on the floor and something like glass breaking. Are you guys all right? I yelled out in a panicked voice.
Yes,
I heard Jack say.
The rocks bumped into a table, but some vase or something fell off. Fuck you, Jack.
I heard Roxy retort. Man, the dynamic of this couple was really something, I thought. I heard the sounds of boxes and furniture being shifted as they continued to move through the room. All was quiet for a time, and then I heard doors opening and closing. This was followed by another round of excruciating silence. At last, I heard Jack's voice call out to me.
Kenny, come down here. We need your help.
I considered what he said, then replied, I thought you guys ordered me to stay here and not come down. Rox's voice filtered up from the basement.
Kenny, get your skinny ass down here, or I'm gonna give you a second asshole.
Jesus, I thought. This Roxy chick sure had some anger management problems. Okay. I yelled back. I'm coming down. I felt my way down the stairs, keeping close to the wall. When I got to the bottom, I could see I was in one very large room, full of boxes and some furniture covered with sheets. On the far side of the room, there was a hallway leading out, and it was from there I could see the glow of Jack and Roxy's flashlights. I made my way over to them. I saw that the hallway was long, probably extending under most of the length of the house. Extending down both sides were a series of doors. It was like looking down a long hallway in a hotel. Some of the doors closest to me were open, and I could see each room had a metal frame bed. This must have been the old maid's quarters, I thought. But back in the day, the Barkers had a staff of servants that did the cooking, cleaning, and caretaking of the grounds. The first two rooms were both empty. Then I came to the third, where Jack and Roxy were waiting. I came up alongside, just as Roxy was placing her coat over a nude Gail Peterson. She was chained to the bed by both her arms and feet.
Fucking monster,
said Roxy, her voice shaking. I could tell she was on the verge of crying. I looked down at Gail. She was semi-conscious, and periodically would let out a loud moan. That's what I heard upstairs, I realized.
She's been drugged,
Jack appraised.
And sexually abused, but not bitten, thank God. We need to look for a key to those chains.
Roxy interjected.
We have to clear the basement first,
she said, now reverting back to her aloof professional demeanor.
There are a few more rooms yet to go.
I followed them as they continued the search, room by room. Five rooms down, Roxy's light shone at another figure on a bed. It was a woman, but I noticed right away that she wasn't chained up like Gail. I gasped when I saw who it was. My God, it's Pamela. I choked out. Everyone thought she just ran off and left this place.
Too late for her,
Roxy said, simply. I looked at her incredulously.
What are you talking about?
I said, sharply. She's breathing. She looks fine. Even her cheeks are rosy. You guys are heroes. You found her. I felt Jack's hand on my shoulder.
No, Kenny. She's not fine. Here, take a look.
Jack reached out, his hand holding a small mirror. He put the mirror alongside Pam's head and tilted it so I had a view. I could see the pillow where her head was laying, but nothing else.
What the hell?
I muttered.
One thing the folklore and movies have correct,
Jack said,
is that vampires have no reflection in a mirror. Pamela is gone. She's now a Homo Nosferatu Vampiris. A vampire.
I snatched the mirror from Jack's hand and looked for myself. I ran the mirror down the length of her body, and the bed looked empty. I could see the depressions in the pillow and mattress where her head and body should be, but there was nothing. After a long moment, I slowly passed the mirror back to Jack and simply said, Okay, I believe you. I believe you about everything. Now what? Roxy spoke next.
We have to release her, Kenny, from the vampiric curse. But it won't be pretty. You'll have to prepare yourself.
I looked at Roxy. I have a feeling it's not as simple as a wooden stake through the heart, I said. Jack and Roxy both shook their heads. Jack pulled out a knife from his black bag. It was wickedly long. The blade looked to be about 7 or 8 inches. One side was razor sharp and curled up to a very nasty pointed tip, while the other had a wicked-looking serrated edge. One side for sticking and slicing, the other for sawing. The blade was bright silver, and the handle appeared to be made from ivory. etched into the blade was some kind of inscription.
Deus lux mea est.
As if reading my mind, Jack explained.
The inscription is in Latin. It means, God is my light. This knife is more than 500 years old. It was used by an esoteric wing of the Catholic Church dedicated to hunting down and killing vampires. Then it came into my possession. It's a long story.
Before I had time to pose another question, Jack plunged the knife into Pam's chest. I gasped, totally shocked by the sudden violence. My God, I thought, what if we made a mistake? And what if she was still alive and still human? All this flashed through my mind in a split second. But then, what I saw next tore away all those concerns. As painful as yanking a scab off a festering wound. And totally changed the way I would look at the world forever. As the silver blade entered Pam's chest, her eyes opened wide. But they were not normal eyes. Her pupils were elliptical, like a snake or a cat, and her irises glowed a bright red. She opened her mouth in a scream, and when she did, I could see a maw filled with needle-like teeth, overshadowed by two wickedly sharp incisors that were curved like a viper's. Black, mucus-like blood ejected out of her throat. She hissed at Jack, and as she attempted to get up and lunge at him, Roxy smacked her hard across the cheek with her crucifix. I saw the Pam Thing's skin sear in a mirror image of the cross, the foul smell of burning flesh stinging my nose. With her cheeks sizzling, Pam turned away from Jack, and suddenly those penetrating eyes locked directly onto mine. I could see a look of recognition play across her face.
Kenny,
heard her exclaim. Her voice the same as that of the sweet teenage girl who had stolen my heart years before.
Kenny, my first love. Sweet, sweet Kenny. The only man I've truly loved. Help me.
She pleaded.
Help me, Kenny. We can be together again, like the old days. Don't you love me, Kenny?
I took a step forward. And Pam, I... Jack cut me off.
Don't listen to her, Kenny. Vampires are the kings of lies and deceit.
I watched, aghast, as Pam turned around on Jack and hissed in a malevolent, guttural tone.
You little fucker. I bet you like little boys, don't you? A friend of Judy's you can't face coming out of the closet. You're on the down low, and your little blonde bitch here has no clue.
I couldn't believe the vile things that continued to pour out of the Pam Thing's mouth. I could see the pure evil that had penetrated her heart, her soul, if she even had one left. Jack had had enough. He pulled out the dagger and thrust it again and again into the monster's chest. As he twisted the blade, black ichor erupted out of the wound and out of the thing's eyes, nose, and mouth. This went on for what seemed like forever, until the creature went silent. I watched as Jack pulled out the blade from her chest with a sickening pop. He took out a vial of water and doused the blade.
It's holy water,
he explained. Then, without further hesitation, Jack took the knife and began to saw into the vampire's neck. It was a horribly gruesome sight, and I had to turn away. The gurgling sounds as Jack cut through the creature's windpipe was too much. I staggered off into the corner and vomited on the floor. The chemical tang of the creature's foul and repellent bodily fluids wafted to my nose, prompting me to retch all the more. Through my pounding ears, I could hear Jack recite the words I assumed also in Latin.
Adjurite, spiritus nequies me per diem omnipotentem.
At last, with the terrible sound of the sawing and hacking was over, I had recovered sufficiently to turn around. Jack had placed Pam's decapitated head atop her chest, the body now physically decaying to resemble the true visage of her one-month-old rotten corpse. I suppose if I had anything left in my stomach, I would have vomited again.
Roxy took in my ashen face, and even though she placed a comforting hand on my shoulder, she gave me a mischievous smile and simply said,
"Welcome to the party, Kenny."
I was still weak in the knees when Jack, now cleaning off his knife, said,
"Okay, we have to keep moving. We have to find Wojciech. He's got to be here somewhere."
We ended up searching the remaining basement rooms, but did not find my employer. And thank God, I didn't find any more of his victims. Hanging on the wall, we found a ring of keys that fit the padlocks holding Gail's chains. We got her unlocked, and I carried her up the stairs. I placed her on a sofa in the home's large living room and covered her with a warm blanket. Roxy came up alongside.
"You stay with her, Kenny. Jack and I will search the guest house. Are there any other hiding places on the estate? Fruit cellars, tornado bunkers, that kind of thing."
I did a quick mental review of the estate's layout. "Each guest house has its own cellar," I explained. "There are no other underground places as far as I know, but check the concrete shed that houses the pool pumps and heating system. It's windowless and dark inside. I've been in there a few times, but not lately." As Jack and Roxy searched the grounds, I sat with Gail. She was still under whatever drugs Wojciech had given her, but I held her hand and spoke to her with words of encouragement. I could feel a periodic squeeze in response. "Good girl," I thought. She was a fighter. A half hour later, Jack and Roxy returned.
"Nothing there,"
Jack reported.
"The place looks clean. Apparently your Wojciech was smart enough not to stay at the same place he was stashing his victims. Or else he got spooked and sensed we were coming. Either way, that's a big loss for us. The bastard is still out there, and I'm betting not far away. But at least we saved this young girl's life."
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
"And killed a vampire as a bonus."
I nodded, then asked the inevitable question. "Should I call the cops now? The real cops?" I smiled at Jack and Roxy. Jack shook her head.
"Not unless you want to spend months trying to convince the authorities he had nothing to do with this kid's abduction," he said. "Or the decapitated body of your old girlfriend. You will, of course, blame the owner, this Wojciech, but they'll point out how the women started going missing after you started working out here, all alone. And they'll never find Wojciech to be able to interview him. He'll be in the wind. You'll be the prime suspect. And if you mention vampires, you'll be locked up in the loony bin. Your best choice is we take Gail and drop her off at your local hospital or the home of your country doctor. She'll get immediate treatment and you won't be involved."
I thought about everything Jack just laid out. He was right. I had no viable options. "Okay," I replied. "Let's take her over to Pine Valley Medical. It's our largest medical clinic in Brewersville. Then I'm good to go, right?" Jack and Roxy exchanged another of their surreptitious glances. I didn't like that. "What else?" I asked. "What's wrong?" Roxy sighed.
"Kenny, there's another more important reason why we don't want you tied up with the cops. Don't you see? Together with us, you just fucked up Wojciech's operation. If you want to call it that. It took months for him to get ownership of this estate. You meddled in his affairs. You had a hand in violating his inner sanctum. You betrayed his trust. You took away his young prize. He'll be out for blood. Literally. Your blood, Kenny. Like it or not, your best choice is to come with us. At least until we can track the bastard down and eliminate him."
I couldn't believe what they were saying. I came to work that morning, like always, finally having a good job and a normal life.
always riding the world, and now within the space of an hour, it seemed to have all been turned upside down. Not only was I now out of a job, I'd be on the run from a fucking vampire, and a pissed off one at that. But no, I wasn't going to be chased out of town. It was my town, goddammit. Roseville was my ancestral home, where I was born and raised, and I would die there. I turned to Jack and Roxy. I know what you're saying, but I'm not going anywhere. This is my town, and I'm not going to be scared away. I can deal with it. Whatever Wojciech's plans, I'll deal with them when the time comes. Come on, let's get Gil to the hospital, and then I'm going home. Jack and Roxy exchanged another of their glances, but said nothing further to dissuade me. We ended up driving our respective vehicles off their stay. Roxy insisted on taking Gil to the hospital because she could switch the plates and change the logos on a van in case it was spotted dropping the girl off. She was always one step ahead, I noted. I trusted him to get Gail to safety, so I headed home. Before we parted ways, Jack told me they'd be staying at the Coal Miner's Inn on the outskirts of town in case I needed to get in touch. Then he gave me one of his water pistols, which I learned was not a normal kid squirt gun, but capable of shooting a high-pressure stream of water at long distances. He also insisted I take an extra vial of the holy water and a blessed crucifix.
"Here,"
he said.
"Take these. If you insist on not staying with us, at least let us make you prepared. If you get turned, I don't want to have to hunt you down. We have enough to deal with."
I took the bag, but still insisted I'd be fine. I looked over at Roxy, and she was giving me that appraising look again, sizing me up, like she was trying to figure if I had what it takes. "I'll be fine," I said, for the upteenth time. Last words of the truly ignorant. By the time I got to my apartment above Woolworth's, it was late afternoon. Good thing I never moved out after landing the job at the Barker Estate, I thought. I was right back to where I was, without a pot to pee in. A loser in a loser town. Now, a few more hours until dark, I wasn't in the mood to go to Captain Jack's. I would have dreaded Pete asking me how my day went. I grabbed a beer out of the fridge. I collapsed into my dilapidated easy chair and turned on the TV. ABC World News Tonight with Peter Jennings was on, and the top story was the Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan. After more than 9 years of fighting, the Russians were finally calling it quits and leaving with their tail between their legs and over 14,000 Russians killed. Jesus, I thought. It was great to see the commies get their asses handed to them, just as they enjoyed our own debacle in Vietnam a decade earlier. But really, what the hell were they thinking? I mean, what nation's stupid enough to try to invade and occupy Afghanistan? It's called the Graveyard of Empires for a damn good reason. Later, as the news concluded, I stared out my living room window at the sunset. I couldn't help it, but I felt a pit in my stomach. I told Jack and Roxy I'd be fine, but I had to be honest with myself. I was scared shitless. I kept replaying the images of Pam staring at me with those serpent-like eyes, her mouth baring those monstrous teeth. I couldn't deny it. Vampires were fucking real. And now, the granddaddy of them all was probably out gunning for me. With the night closing in, I closed the curtains. I sat back down in front of the TV, looking for a mindless sitcom that would distract me. An hour later, after my sixth or seventh beer, and despite the incessant worry, I slipped into a fretful sleep. I was woken up by the sound of tapping. I raised my head, groggily, and tried to get my bearings. I was still in my armchair. The tapping was coming from the window. Something was tapping on the glass from the outside. I couldn't move, paralyzed by sheer terror. Not simply from the realization that there was someone outside my window, but more so because I lived on the third floor, and I had no balcony. I continued to sit there, frozen by fear, unable to get up, unable to move. My heart jackhammering in my chest. I naively hoped that whatever was out there would give up and go away. but the tapping continued. Another rapid tap, like someone would knock on a door. Rather, it was a slow tap, determined, with several seconds in between. Methodical, calculating. Minutes went by and the tapping didn't let up. I felt like I was going mad. I knew I had no other window I could look out through on this side of the apartment. I thought of going outside to confront whatever it was, but then I'd be exposed, vulnerable. I had no choice. I summoned every ounce of courage I could muster, stood up, took a breath, and tore back the curtains. I screamed. There, in front of my window, was a man. Older, maybe in his 40s. Full head of silver-gray hair slicked back along his skull. His face was translucent, with dark blue veins crisscrossing the skin around his temples. His eyes had vertical slit pupils with bright yellow irises that were ringed in black, surrounded by whites, exploded with heavy red veins. The fiend had abnormally red lips, parted in a knowing smile that was way too large for a living person. His mouth was full of wickedly jagged, piranha-like teeth, accented by two longer, curved fangs that were at least twice the size of any Timbo rattlesnake that I had ever come across. But it was the utter dichotomy of the horrific image before me that struck me the most. The apparition was dressed impeccably. It would look to be an old-fashioned dark zoot suit, with his flashy tie, flopping handkerchief, and diamond cufflinks. He looked like a man about town, the perfect dandy. Around his neck was a chain with some kind of medallion, embossed with a scythe encircled with what looked to be Cyrillic characters. I hesitated to look further down, knowing already what I was going to see. When I finally did, my eyes were drawn to his shiny black dress oxfords on feet that dangled in the air. He was floating there, with nothing but the night's blackness behind him.
"Hello, Mr. Grimes,"
came an accented, almost cultured voice, slightly muffled by the glass.
"I'm so glad to finally meet you in person. We have some unfinished business to discuss, don't we? Please invite me in, Mr. Grimes."
I took a step back. Jack didn't mention what to do in this situation, but I'd seen enough horror movies to know inviting a vampire into one's home was never a good idea. "Fuck you, poor chick. Go away. I don't invite you. You killed a dear friend of mine, and did God only knows what sick things to that young girl, Gail. Take your pale, ugly ass and scramble back to Transylvania, or wherever the fuck you came from." The vampire's smug smirk suddenly disappeared, and then he hissed through the window.
"Let me in, boy, or I'll skin you alive, slowly, until you beg to die."
"Go to hell, you ugly fucker," I yelled back bravely, even as I felt the urine involuntarily dribble down my leg, let loose in my overwhelming fear. Suddenly, the glass shattered, and Wojciech's arm snaked inside. If I hadn't taken a step back previously, his claw-like hand would surely have grabbed a hold of me. As it was, the shock caused me to fall backwards. After landing on my ass, I frantically grabbed the armchair in a feeble attempt to stand back up. As I did so, I could see Wojciech give a sadistic smile of satisfaction. He knew he'd scared me, had intimidated me. "He thinks he's won," I thought. I knew I couldn't let him have that satisfaction. I had to show strength of will and resolve now, or he'll forever have the upper hand. I got up on shaky legs and looked him straight into his vein-laden, ancient eyes. "Go away," I ordered. "I do not invite you. You are not welcome here. Be gone with you, in the name of God and all that is holy." I expected my show of defiance would make Wojciech take pause, but instead, the old vampire only became further enraged, snarling.
"Let me in, you little snot-nosed shit."
Then, As I stared, transfixed, he began morphing into a hideous visage. No doubt his true, monstrous persona. His tongue rolled out of his mouth, long and split down the middle, ending in a fork that flicked back and forth like that of a snake's seeking their prey. Vestigial taste buds resembling cancerous pink canker sores oozed some thick and vile clotted mucus. His nose flattened, becoming leaf-shaped. His ears became elongated, growing internal acoustical ridges, distinctly bat-like. The sound of splintering bone, Wojciech's outstretched arms lengthened by several feet. His hands growing new fingers, which elongated to form the bony ribs for membranous bat-like wings. As Wojciech's clothes ripped and fell from his body like discarded skin, his wings grew and attached to the side of his body with new sinew and muscle. I watched as his skin and face erupted in vile, pus-filled sores, becoming a haphazard patchwork of weeping abscesses. Purplish pars quickly became fodder for new hair that began covering his body, a dark, coarse mammalian fur akin to that of a vampire bat. Despite all these vile and horrific manifestations, the final and most malevolent transformation took place with Wojciech's eyes. They became bulbous and swollen, several times their normal size, threatening to disgorge themselves from their sockets. As I stared at them, their eyes began glowing a bright, translucent red. With the pupils as the nexus, the red began to swirl in a circular motion. Slow at first, then tremendously fast. It was like watching a vortex of water cascading down an endless hole, a whirlpool sucking everything down. Sucking in my thoughts, my energy, my strength of will.
Yes, I heard Wojciech coo. Come closer, boy. Have no fear. You can be one of my chosen ones. Embrace your destiny. Come. Come to me now.
Drawn into Wojciech's kaleidoscope eyes, I took a step forward, then another. Through the hypnotic haze, I watched in horror as his claw-like hands grabbed purchase on the inside of the windowsill. The glass was gone, but he couldn't get in, could he? With two more steps on my part, and I'd be in his arms. Summon up every ounce of willpower that I could muster, I broke contact with Wojciech's eyes. To this day, I'm not sure how I managed that. It had to have been only through the strength of God's will. Get out of my head, I remember shouting as I bent over and grasped my head in both hands, trying desperately to close off my mind from his thoughts. I felt like I had the worst migraine of my entire life as I struggled to shake off Wojciech's intrusive embrace. As the fog slowly cleared from my mind, I suddenly became aware of the cool breeze blowing in through the window. Yes, that's right. I remembered the window had been broken, and that could be a good thing, I suddenly realized. A very good thing. With no barrier between us, there was a weapon that I could now use to my advantage. I stood back up and had a moment of panic trying to remember where I had left it, but then quickly spotted Jack's water gun lying on the table next to the chair. I snatched it up. It had already been pumped and primed. Take a hike, asshole, I screamed as I aimed it right at Wojciech's face and pulled the trigger. The holy water hit him at high pressure, right square between those red, hypnotic eyes, and I could see the flesh dissolve at the point of impact, drilling a hole into the vampire's head. He let out a high-pitched, woman-like scream as his head jerked back from the force of the jet stream. He hovered there in midair for only a second longer, the skin on his face beginning to liquefy and slough off. And then he dropped unceremoniously to the ground. He hit hard, smacking the concrete with a bone-breaking crash. I looked down and could see Wojciech lying on his side, writhing in pain and grasping his ruined face.
I thought about raining down more of the holy water just to inflict more pain on the bastard. But before I could, he morphed into something I could barely fathom. Something with multiple arthropod-like segmented legs and a large, furry, bulbous body. As I watched, horrified, the thing scuttled off down the alley at an alarming speed and quickly disappeared around the side of a nearby building. I fell to my knees, catching my breath. I felt relief, but it was a small respite. I had been damn lucky, and I had won that battle. But could I win the war? I had no doubt the fiend would never give up. He'd be back. I was just a simple country boy. How in the world could I fight such a monster? I didn't have the knowledge or the expertise. I needed to learn. I needed to know how to hunt down Wojciech and his kind, before he made even more beings like himself. Feeding on small towns like Roseville, where the forgotten, the lower income, and disadvantaged disappear without anyone giving a shit. I could understand now what drove Jack and Roxy, what made them so passionate about what they do. Without hesitation, I picked up the phone and called the coal miners in. A few hours later, I was having a beer with Jack and Roxy in their room.
You did good, Kenny.
Roxy complimented, after hearing my account of Wojciech's visit. I think that's high praise coming from you. I smiled.
Well, Jack and I had a feeling you were going to have to learn the hard way, that vampires carry grudges, and they have long memories, and they're hard to fight on your own.
I nodded. I set my beer down and looked at them both. Jack, Roxy, I stated, trying to form the right words. I want you to teach me how to be a vampire slayer. There's no turning back for me now. I've got to get to Wojciech before he gets to me, and to avenge what he did to Pam. She didn't deserve what he did to her, what she became. I want to kill the bastard and all of his kind. If you're willing to teach me, I'm with you. I'll give you 100%. I'll be all in, all the way. What do you say? Roxy looked at Jack and winked. Jack, in turn, looked at me and said,
"We have a small group, Kenny. Me, Rox, and my two friends, Steve and Tom. They're back at home base in L.A. If you want to join us, you'll have to relocate there. You'll have enough money to live on. We have benefactors that fund us well. The Magnus clan of the Vampires... long story there, Kenny. We'll fill you in on the road tomorrow. Wojciech is in the wind for now, and we have another vampire we've tracked to North Carolina."
I stuck out my hand. "Thank you," I said. "Thank you both." Jack shook it and said,
"Welcome aboard, vampire slayer."
As Roxy in turn shook my hand, I had to ask her the question that had been on my mind since first meeting her. "Don't take this the wrong way," I said. "And I don't mean to pry into a sensitive subject, but regarding the bite on your neck..." I trailed off.
"Yes," prompted Roxy.
"Well, if you got bit by that vampire, Tanya, you mentioned, then why didn't you, turn into a vampire as well?" Roxy smirked.
"Well, maybe it's because I'm just one tough son of a bitch. Took more than a pound of flesh to take me down."
I looked at her, dubiously. Jack laughed and said,
"Don't believe Roxy's bullshit, Kenny. The truth is, she had one thing going for her that Tanya didn't take into account."
I looked back to Roxy. "And what was that?" I asked. Roxy smiled.
"Because I'm a familiar, Kenny. I already had the blood of another vampire. His name's Simon, coursing through my veins. Basically, it provided me the antibodies and protection from Tanya's bite. I still had a rough go of it for days, though. I was in a near coma, but mostly delirious. I dreamed of the most perverted and illicit thoughts, sinful and evil. It was terrible. I can't even talk about it. I might have succumbed, but I think I got through it because of Jack. When I came to, he was always there, always holding my hand, telling me to fight, giving me the strength. Eventually, my fever broke, and I knew I had beaten the Mortis infection. Trust me, Tanya was one pissed-off vampire when she found out she failed to turn me.
I looked at both Jack and Roxy. I still had one final question. Was it familiar? I asked. They both began laughing. They were laughing so hard I saw tears come to their eyes.
Kid.
Roxy was finally able to choke out.
Grab a pad of paper. I can see Jack and I have our work cut out for us.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Save big during Labor Day at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances. Plus, buy more to get up to an additional 20% off. Shop even more savings with 3 Stay-Green 1-cubic foot vegetable and flower garden soil bags for $10. This Labor Day, take care of your home for less at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9/3. Soil offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.